Major players in the court of the uncountable stairs and of treaties and trade deals with everyone from the Grey's massive collection colony to Rangi, the Polynesian sky god. You know, the one you see on late night TV hogging his self-help books. You own factories, retail chains, and companies that make computers, cell phones, military drones, water purifying straws for the third world, and wind turbines. Oh, and heroin, lots and lots of heroin, a major part of your bottom line, I guess. The Fay families, as a group, including the Ankus, are about the third largest producers and distributors in the world of smack, I believe you people call it. The smug smirk slid from Anku's face. So, I said, finishing off my drink, how can I be of service to the Sugar Plum Mafia?
You live up to your reputation, Mr. Ballard. That much is evident, Anku said. I want you to find my daughter, Can. She's missing.
You have more money than God's loan shark, I said. You have your own army of house knights, I nodded toward Burris. You own security companies. You can buy whole detective agencies and put them to work on finding your girl. You can employ more hackers and data miners than the Chinese government and the Russian mob combined, not to mention you have enough juice on the street to put a bounty out and have every low-life, junkie, dirty cop and street hustler looking for her. Why bring me in?
I have done all of that, Anku said, and more. My daughter's trail is completely cold. I understand you have acquired a reputation for finding things and people that seem to have vanished without a trace. I think Cairn has been swallowed up by some part of the life so deep and so foul that all my resources can't reach her.
But you think I can? I asked.
You're Latham Ballard, he said. Just your name has cachet in some very, very dark places. Places my people cannot go.
I have unlocked the Master at Slumming achievement, I said. True. Anku's companion with the wine looked confused by that. How cold a trail are we talking about here?
Can has been missing since 2009, Anku said, 9 years after my wife, her mother, the Lady Osperia, died in a car accident in Spain.
How old was she when she disappeared? I asked.
13, Anku said. Memory bit into me. 13 was the age I'd left home.
You've been looking for her for all these years and not even a lead?
Anku shifted in his chair. I didn't know enough about this guy except by reputation to read him, but that squirm was the first tell I noticed.
If my people had made any progress, Mr. Ballard, you would still be in that Houston alley, nestled up with your garbage and your vomit and not drinking my good whiskey. I have exhausted every possible resource at my disposal, including a pilgrimage back to the shining lands of our creation to scry in the waters of Alfine for her. Nothing.
You know she's probably dead, right? I said, leaning forward in my chair. All these years, no word, no leads. It doesn't look good.
Then we need proof to that end, White Wine said. His voice was exactly what I had thought it would be, nasally, like he was afraid to smell air contaminated by commoners. This, Anku said, sounding a little pained, is Lord Wires Thakulakanuyoye, of one of the most prominent of the Equinox houses. He is Cairn's betrothed.
Ah, okay, I said. So this new urgency in finding your daughter wouldn't have anything to do with an arranged marriage agreement between your house and Lord Snuffle of Pagasus here, right?
The girl is of age now.
Wiras a Thakaluka Canna Nuyoyo said.
The agreement must be fulfilled or dismissed. I need proof if she's dead.
I don't work for you, Pencil Neck, I said to Prince Pino. I looked over to Anku. I'm not even sure I work for you. You want me to chase down a girl and drag her back here for some bullshit marriage she had no say in? I jerked a thumb at Wiras a Thakaluka like a New Yoye, and I'd lay a good money on her not wanting any part of it.
You may not believe this, Anku said, but I love my daughter very much. We Fae do not conceive many children. Cairn is our only one. My wife, my love, is gone. Cairn was all I had left of her. The happiest I've ever been in this world, or any other, was when the three of us were together.
I saw some emotion pass behind those dark eyes. It was a mystery to me what it was. Anku's perfectly modulated voice cracked a little as he spoke.
I want her home safe, Mr. Balhad. I promise I will listen to her wishes about the wedding and abide by them.
We're asked that a lack a luck a new yo ye didn't like that. He started to open his mouth to say so, but Anku shut him down with a stern look.
I just want to know that she's safe. I'd like her home, but I won't force her.
What's in all this for me other than a huge pain in the ass? I asked.
I could threaten you. Anku said, tell you how every person you've ever worked with or cared for would be dead in 24 hours if you refused.
I leaned back in my chair. Fuck 'em, I said. You go on and kill 'em, see if I give a damn. Anku smiled.
You mean that, don't you? I heard that about you too. Quite the mercenary, quite the loner. Many of those tales about you seem to end with you being the only one still alive. You really don't care if I were to kill every single one of your associates and loved ones, do you?
Only one way to find out, I said. Folks who run with me and don't end up dead may be harder to grease than you think, Theo, and anyone stupid enough to love me gets what they deserve.
I see. Anku said, well then, of course there's money, but I know men like you acquire and lose it with great rapidity, and it is really more of a means to an end for your lot, so I won't insult you with an offer.
By all means, insult away, I said.
Name a price. He said, I'll triple it.
The look I gave him must have made him realize he shouldn't have.
Well, lastly, he said, slipping his hand into his jacket pocket, I can offer you this.
He produced a small black glass bottle. The bottle had a rubber dropper-style cap like you might see on eye or eardrops. I sensed power off the bottle without even trying. My grandmother told me never to accept potions from fairy folk, I said. Those could be magical roofies for all I know.
If I had wanted you glamoured, Mr. Ballard, you would be licking my shoe right now. No, I need you with your somewhat odious personality and faculties fully intact. What do your perceptions tell you about this bottle?
Anku said as he unscrewed the top of the bottle. I opened my third eye to a tiny slit and felt the waves of energy in the bottle sync perfectly with my own aura. What the hell? It feels like it's mine, I said. Anku squeezed something out of the bottle by way of the dropper and moved the dropper and pipette over my palm. A drop of a glowing bluish-white liquid shivered at the mouth of the pipette.
May I demonstrate,
he said. I nodded. He released the rubber bulb and the glowing liquid dropped from the glass pipette. It fell toward my palm and then stopped and hovered, then drifted downward lazily like a dandelion seed. The light was brilliant blue-white like an arc of lightning at the instant it strikes. It flashed like a firefly, and I slowly raised my hand toward it. This belonged to me. It was part of me somehow. I gently touched the drifting, flaring light with the tip of my index finger and felt the emotion connected with the memory of my pa sitting me on his lap in his old worn leather recliner. I could smell his hair tonic and his English leather. The stale scent of tobacco, his coffin nails, he called them. He was reading to me from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Every night he'd let me pick a volume, and then we'd randomly read an entry. It was the only good, solid memory of my pa I had, and it filled me with warm feelings of security and belongings, love and joy. Joy. It was something I hadn't felt in a very long time. Was incapable of feeling any more. The tiny lightning droplet sizzled against my fingertip and was gone. The emotion faded just as quickly. That's my joy, I almost whispered. Anku nodded. The twist of a smile had returned to the corners of his lips again. Yes, he said, it certainly is.
This tiny sample of it was expensive, even for someone with my considerable means. To us Fae, the distilled emotions of humans are a very powerful drug, very valuable. You bargained away your joy to House Tycho in exchange for their adoption of a human ghost into their domains, I am led to understand. The girl had died in a car accident. She must have been very precious to you. Joy freely given is a very powerful narcotic indeed, Mr. Ballard. I said nothing. I rubbed my index finger and thumb together, trying to feel any remainder of the tiny drop. There was none. The melting ice in my empty glass cracked and shifted slightly. Find my daughter, and I will buy back every lost drop of your joy from the Lunar Lords and return it to you.
Counterproposal, I croaked, trying to get my head back in the game.
You use your position in the Court of the Uncountable Stairs and your pull with the Tycho clan, and you get that ghost released from her duties. She gets a walk. No more doing shit jobs for you all. You do that and I'll find your girl.
Again, most impressive, Anku said, putting the empty bottle away. Most mortals given a drop of pure, undistilled joy would do almost anything for more. This little ghost must have been very special to you.
Her name was Tori Lynn, and a million lifetimes ago we had loved. She had been one of the only people in this world to see the real me and still love me. She died.
Joy is only worth something if you got a reason for it, I said.
We have a deal? Anku looked over to Weirass a Faka Luka Nayu Yao Yo Ye, and the little fop nodded.
Yes, Anku said, we have a deal.
4. 2 hours later, we were in the air on Anku's private jet, an Airbus A380. The thing was a fucking hotel with wings, 2 levels. Bars, conference rooms, a lounge, and a full kitchen with all the fawning staff to go with it. You could easily seat hundreds of people in here, crushed in cattle car style like most folks have to fly. I wondered if the folks who flew this way could even survive a coach class flight without therapy for the trauma. I was a long-ass way from the trailer park in Welch. I ordered a scotch, stretched my legs out, a luxury on most flights, and got comfy in the padded leather seat. I didn't buckle up, a rebel even in gilded luxury. Burris was sitting across from me. He looked at me like a cat that had just swallowed a mouse past its expiration date.
What?
I said. His eyes flickered to the glass and then back to me. He said nothing.
Don't like this, huh?
I said, raising the glass and taking a sip.
We were told you had dried yourself out,
he said.
Well, sucks to be we then, don't it? I said. I'm officially off the wagon. What's your beef anyway, raised by warrior monks? Never touch the stuff? It'll make baby Jesus cry?
Something shifted behind Burris's eyes, but his face remained stone.
It undercuts your performance, makes you sloppy and careless, and can leave you defenseless. He said, as a wizard, you should already know that. As former Nightwise, they should have trained this juvenile behavior out of you before you ever hit the streets. I don't intend to carry your besotted ass through this, that's all.
I noticed again that Burris had no British accent. He didn't seem to have any accent my ear could pick up.
Shit, I said. I can conjure like Dr. Motherfucking Strange, master of the mystic arts on crank, even with a snoot full,
I said and took another drink.
We'll see, he said and lowered the back of his seat to get more comfortable. With that kind of attitude, why did you stop?
Trying to be something I fucking wasn't for someone who should have known better, I said, didn't take.
Obviously,
Burris said. He closed his eyes and I assume he slept. Maybe he was meditating or hibernating or something. I don't know what the hell Vulcans do. I was not happy to have a sidekick in this caper, especially one I didn't pick myself. Burris coming along was the one term I couldn't get Anku to back off on.
I had a large duffel bag stowed in my private freaking bedroom on this plane, which held half a mill of the Fay mobster's money, all washed and clean as a whistle. He didn't even blink when I told him I'd need that for walking around money. In the seat next to me was a $14,000 Solaris smartphone with better-than-military encryption, which Anku handed me when I told him I needed ultra-secure communication to reach out to my people. But when it came to his night, Burris, he simply ignored every argument I gave him.
"Burris is my insurance policy," Anku said. "He makes sure you don't simply take my money and disappear, or go on a long vacation instead of looking for Cairn. You'll find him very unobtrusive, and he is not without his talents."
And that was that, so I was stuck with Burris. Swell. Talents my ass. If looking for a little girl lost comes down to a fucking firefight, I know enough on my own to get the hell out of that. I picked up the black and gold Solaran and dialed a number I knew was to a KFC in Okinawa. It was routed and rerouted about 200 times, bounced off a few satellites, and finally was answered.
"Talk."
A gruff bass voice on the other side of the world said, "Howdy, I wanted to pre-order a large 12-piece bucket original recipe and large sides of chicken feet, rice balls, and squid ink for Christmas Day," I said.
"It's the asshole that walks like a man,"
Grenner said over the line. "We clean?" I asked the best damn hacker on the planet. His name was Robert Shelton, but everyone knew him by his handle, Grenner. He was one of those handful of people that Anku had been talking about who had ridden with me and lived.
"Affirmative," Grenner said. "Whatever you need, Ballard, it's already gonna cost you double, 'cause it's you."
"Oh, come on, really?"
"After how you did Magdalena dirty, you're lucky I'm taking your calls at all."
Grenner said, "She was the best fucking thing to happen to your miserable ass, and you pissed it away." "Look, that was almost a year ago," I said. "Give it a fucking rest."
"Double," he said.
"Well, lucky for me, I got the money to handle that," I said.
"Yeah, this week," Grenner said. "You still owe me $30K for debugging that shitty Herobrine thing that was killing people. I got mouths to feed, motherfucker."
"Calm your tits, Grenner," I said. "Add the 30th out of my bill for this one. I'll wire you the money when we land, okay?"
"What idiot is giving you his ATM card?"
Grenner asked. "The idiot I want you to dig up everything on," I said. "His name is Theodore Anku."
"The fucking alien mobster,"
Grenner said.
"Have you lost your fucking mind dealing with those ass-probing motherfuckers?"
"He's not an alien," I said. "He's Fay." "Okay, well, they're kind of like aliens, but not exactly." Grenner made a whistling flying saucer sound like something from a 50s monster movie. "Knock that shit off," I said. "I want everything on him, his business and his family, especially his daughter, Cairn. She's been in the wind since 2009.
"Oh, don't make it too easy for me, Ballard,"
Grenner said.
"Okay, 50 large plus the 30 you owe me. Hell, let's just go ahead and round that to a nice even 100,000 for that tits comment. And how you walked out on Magdalena."
I sighed. "You're a fucking brigand," I said. "If I didn't know it was going to be the baby and Christine, I'd tell you to piss off. How is your beautiful wife and little Latham?"
"In your fucking dreams," Grenner chuckled. "Little Turing is doing great. His mom is still a fucking smoking hot sexy kitten MILF. And for some god-awful reason, she still loves the hell out of you, hillbilly."
I heard Christine shout out in the background, "Hi, Ballard. Thanks for paying for Turing's college." I laughed. "Better than you deserve, asshole," I said to Grenner. "Both of them."
"Got that right," he said. "Okay, man, I'll get on it once I see the digits in my account.
Try not to have a close encounter with a rectal probe if you can help it.
Thanks, Mom, I said. I'll send pictures. Talk soon.
Grinner said, and I was listening to flat, dead silence over the line. I called one of Anku's people on the number he had given me and arranged for the money to be wired to Grinner's dummy account du jour. I asked one of the nice attendants for another drink and snuggled up across the aisle from my new bestest buddy. A few benzos from the bottle in my pocket, some more scotch, and I tiptoed past the Sandman into the realm of drugged, dreamless sleep. We landed at the Athens International Airport. It was pretty much like every other major airport I'd ever been through, a bland cross between a shopping mall and a subway station. It did my heart good to know that the birthplace of Western civilization had three frozen yogurt kiosks. From here, we'd take a hovercraft over to the island of Spetses, where the super rich played while the folks here on the mainland watched their life savings crumble like a temple to Apollo. I made a quick stop at one of my drops in an airport locker here. I grabbed a few useful odds and ends, some of my clothes, fake IDs, and a fresh burner cell phone. I stashed a hunk of the cash Anku had given me for a rainy day. Other people had houses, bedrooms, closets. I had dead drops, bus, rail, and plane lockers, and bolt holes. There was a photo of me and August Hyde taped to the door of the locker. We were laughing, sitting in a cafe in Rio. For a second, all the years folded like a paper fan, and I was beside him in that Tula bunker in the Argentinian jungle, his rune-covered Browning high power blasting away at the rustling things that had once been men coming out of every shadow. I heard his voice, calm like a teacher instructing a pupil, which I guess in a way he was. Grab the brain slides, Latham. Get the brain and go for the stairs, boy. I pulled a picture off the locker door, crumpled it, and dropped it in a trash can alongside greasy Sbarro boxes and discarded luggage claim tickets. I wish memories were as disposable. There was a bulletproof luxury SUV waiting for us on the tarmac. As we drove into airport traffic, Burris and the driver spoke softly in Greek. The knight leaned back to talk to me from the front passenger seat.
They told me they have a boat waiting to take us over to the island. The Anku family has a house overlooking a private beach on the northwest side of Spetses. We'll be staying there. Karen's apartment is in the city on the eastern side of the island.
Yeah, I caught some of that, I said. My Greek's not as good as my Latin, but it'll do. Kind of weird for a 13-year-old kid to have her own place in the middle of Party Central, ain't it?
Not if you're this kind of rich, Burris said. Karen was a very independent kid after her mother passed away.
What was your read on her? I asked. The driver had turned onto a congested central street. Thousands of protesters were clogging the entrance to a large skyscraper that was corporate headquarters to one of the nation's banks. The protest had spilled out onto the street and cars were honking, drivers shouting and gesturing angrily as traffic had slowed to a crawl through the chanting, equally angry mob. Our driver swore under his breath.
My opinions are not going to help you find her, Burris said.
I shook my head and looked out the window. Our dark little air-conditioned cocoon creeped along through a screaming, shouting sea of angry faces. First it was unemployment and corruption, then the austerity shell game, then the referendum vote, then the run on the banks, insane inflation, and then the fight over immigration of refugees. Through the tinted windows I saw a kid probably in his early 20s. He was wearing no shirt and had tattoos of Greek football team logos on his chest, arms, and back. He was pounding his fists against the bulletproof glass. His eyes were glazed over, stupid with raw hatred. I doubted he had a clue what he was protesting, but it was an excuse to meet girls, get wasted, and wreck stuff. Oh, and blame somebody else. An ideal little vacation from the shit pile of his own life. It's sad how little history or people really change. We just keep doing laps. A thought occurred to me as we pulled free of the mob and the SUV accelerated again. All those times I saved the world with some snappy spell or daring last-second plan, I was saving it for a whole bunch of bullet-headed, mouth-breathing goons. No, that's not true. I was saving it for me to save my handsome ass. It may be a fucking circus on fire, but at least I got good seats. The boat waiting for us at a private slip was a 48-foot Cantius speedboat. Like everything else the Ankus owned, it was expensive and high quality, just like yours truly, except he was only renting me.
We headed out to sea, and I had the onboard hostess fix me up with a cold Corona. I unbuttoned and took off my shirt, tossed it in a deck chair, lit up a cigarette, and felt the sun, the cool sea air, and the spray kiss me.
I'm sorry we didn't think to drag the couch out here on the deck or run the stars and bars up the flagpole to make you feel a little more at home, Burris said.
I looked over to the night. He was standing with his arms crossed, scanning the horizon, his eyes hidden behind his Maybach sunglasses. He looked like a cross between Othello and the Terminator. "Expecting an assassination attempt from seagulls?" I asked, burping a little from the beer.
"The Ankus have political enemies and business rivals," he said. "I have no doubt they all know about you since we scooped you up. They may decide to grab you to find out what you're up to, see if it gives them a tactical advantage, or they may decide just to kill you to derail whatever it is they think you were doing for the family. So relax, get drunk, and enjoy the ride. One of us has to do his job."
"I bet you are a fucking madman at the company Christmas party," I said, and turned back to enjoy the breathtaking view. We were crossing the blue glass waters of the Saronic Gulf. 4 beers, half a pack of cigarettes, and plenty more stimulating conversation from Burris later, we were slowing and making our way along the Gulf of Argolis toward Baltiza Bay on the eastern side of Spetses. Off to our starboard was a yacht so big it made our 48-footer look like a dinghy. The ship was gliding along at a leisurely pace with hundreds of beautiful partygoers hanging off its rails, drinking, drugging, and dancing on its decks. The sound system on the yacht was throbbing as it blasted Bon Bon by Ira Estrafi across the bay, probably killing aquatic life with the decibel level. To port, you could see the labyrinth of the city the isle was named for. Whitewashed, box-like buildings were stacked side by side and seemingly atop one another, rising up the hillside of the island. Tiny terraces and colorful shuttered windows breaking the almost geometric solidarity of the cozy homes and shops. I could see tourists and locals streaming through the crowded, winding cobblestone streets tucked tightly between the structures. At the water's edge were marinas with boats of every size and shape imaginable, bobbing gently in the turquoise waters, as well as seaside cafes with patrons enjoying seafood and beers under large, shady umbrellas. If 13-year-old me had been here, I'm pretty damn sure I'd never have left. It made me try to connect a little with Cairn. Did she leave all this willingly, or was she taken? And if it was of her own free will, what had driven her out of paradise? Our boat took us up the eastern face of the island, past crowded public beaches and pristine private ones. The sand on the shoreline gleamed like powdered gold, kissing water of liquid sapphire. I think I understood why Anku had a home here. This place was as close to any I'd ever seen on Earth to match the otherworldly beauty of Faerie. We went around the northern tip of the island, and I saw villas dotting the sides of the hilly island. Nestled among the myrtle and pine trees, I saw groves of lemon and fig trees on terraces of land along the hills. Eventually, we docked at the private pier that also housed a small and powerful-looking cigarette boat and a 130-foot yacht. Men who looked more like soldiers than dockhands caught the mooring lines and helped tether us to our section of the pier. There was a winding set of wooden stairs that led up the hills to the rear of the beach house. Burris and I carried our bags up the winding staircase. Servants offered to carry everything up, but we both tacitly refused. The house was a luxury fortress with a stunning view of the sea and the mountain the house rested at the top of. We were shown to our rooms and told that dinner would be ready around 6. I dropped my single, battered old canvas bag with the zipper that stuck sometimes on the floor next to the bed. The bag was the color of sand and covered with poorly drawn runes and the logos of old bands like the Stones, Kiss, the DKs, and Lynyrd Skynyrd, all in black Sharpie. It was my bag of magic tricks, and it was the oldest thing I owned. It had left the trailer park in my hand when I was the same age Cairn had been when she had disappeared, 13. Jesus, that was a long time ago. A lot of miles since then. Most folks who knew me well enough for me to give a shit about their opinion would say I was still, in all the essential ways, a 13-year-old. Sad, but pretty much true. I figured one of the grotesque goodies in my bag would help me narrow down the search for the girl. First, I needed to check out her place, which Burris had assured me had not been altered in any significant way since her vanishing act in 2009. I unlaced and kicked off my steel-toed boots, fell back onto the bed, and was asleep in short order. I awoke with the knight standing over me, jabbing a finger into my chest.
Dinner,
Burris said, and walked through the open door. He didn't bother to close it. I rolled off the bed, shut the door, and grabbed a quick shower. I finally changed out of the Houston clothes and traded them for a Rick and Morty t-shirt and jeans. As I sat at the edge of the bed and slipped on my boots, I thought about the problem of ditching my asshole chaperone. I retrieved a little something from my bag and headed down to eat. The spread was as top shelf as everything else had been. I pushed some food around my plate and had a few glasses of wine. Burris ate sparingly and narrowed his eyes at me across the table. Yes, I'll eat my veggies, I said, draining my glass of wine. The knight sighed and sipped his beer.
You're a waste of time and money, he said. Fortunately, Anku has plenty of both.
Never Mr. Anku, I said, pouring myself another glass. It's always just Anku. Why don't you kiss your boss's ass like all of his other drones, Burris? Burris, what the hell is your first name anyway? Did they give you one when they grew you in the lab?
The edges of Burris's lips curled a millimeter.
Vigil, he said.
A hint of northern street accent slipped out as he continued.
My grandma told me my mama named me that because it was a long, hard labor, and Mom and I both kept vigil. I'm loyal to my house. I'm willing to take a bullet for Anku. I'm not here to prop up his ego. That's enough.
It was my turn to give him a smile. Maybe you're not as big a tool as I thought you were, Vigil.
I palmed the small bottle that I had taken out of my bag from my jeans pocket, hiding it with my linen napkin. I allowed my hand to pass over my wine glass, and a few drops of liquid from the bottle fell into my wine as I raised the napkin to dab my lips. I raised my glass with my free hand to toast as I put the napkin and bottle back under the table. Vigil raised his bottle of Mythos beer in kind.
Dulcis Bacchus sanguinum et sanguinum Gaia sensus vestri ut melgiatus mea implebitur hoc donum tibi.
Odd toast, Vigil said. Sounds like a spell.
I shrugged and drained my glass. It was on a little bottle I saw once. It was supposed to hold some of the god Bacchus's blood. I always thought it was like a prayer to the Greek god of partying.
Well, no partying tonight, Burris said. Tomorrow morning we drive into the city and go over Cairn's apartment. I want you straight. Time to start earning your pay, Ballard.
I need to go over the place alone, I said, refilling my glass and gesturing to one of the servants with the empty wine bottle. The guy took the bottle, nodded, and went around the corner. I'm good at doing this, but I have my own way of going about it, and my way is a solo act.
It isn't now, Vigil said.
I started to reply. Instead, I drained another glass of wine.
Whatever you say, partner,
I said as they returned with another bottle of wine. We retreated to the den. I made a play for the remote, but Burris snagged it first. I figured I was doomed to an evening of watching ESPN, but to my surprise, he stopped when he spotted Reservoir Dogs.
I love this movie,
he said, stretching out on one of the couches with his second beer.
I've seen it 100 times.
Same, I said. An odd question tumbled into my brain. So who do you think is the good guy in this, the cop or the thief?
Both, Vigil said, and neither. They both have a code, and they both honored it. Sometimes a code is all you have to keep you human, keep you standing upright and breathing.
And sometimes it gets your ass killed, I said.
A weariness settled over me, and I realized how many oaths I had broken, how many promises I had failed or threw away on an altar of selfishness and self-aggrandizement. I knew who I was dealing with now, and it made me a little sadder. I had hoped Vigil was an idiot, a drone. He wasn't.
Vigil glanced over to me on my couch, nodded at the screen where Harvey Keitel was being a total badass.
It ain't no Pulp Fiction, but this cool.
Yep, I said, cool.
I downed 2 more bottles of wine, a bottle of Sans Rival Ouzo, and a few beers. Vigil stopped watching the flat screen, which was the size of a small movie theater screen. He looked at me, shook his head, and finally excused himself for the night.
You're going to hate me in the morning,
Burris said as he climbed the stairs.
I already do,
I said, waving as he disappeared upstairs. After he was gone, I waited about 20 minutes and then whispered the final trigger of the spell that was spun with the drops of God's blood.
Hoc donum tibi. Before the last syllable had faded, the working took, and I was sober, stone-cold sober, and poor Burris upstairs had just inherited my drunken buzz I had spent all evening building for him. I wandered over to the villa's garage and was not disappointed. Top fucking shelf. I decided to pass on the Lamborghini and the Bugatti parked there, opting to take one of the motorcycles, a sleek black NCR M16 Street Fighter. I eschewed the helmet. Yeah, I know, but we've already established that I'm an idiot. Tying my hair back and out of my eyes, the instrument panel included a hands-free cell phone, GPS, and a compact but powerful-looking sound system. I wondered which button fired the phasers. This thing cost a hell of a lot of money, and it was a far, far cry from the old Suzuki dirt bikes I used to ride and race when I was a kid. I pushed the ignition, kicking the bike in the guts. It snarled back at me. I snapped on the headlight, fiddled with the satellite radio until music spilled out of the speakers and spun out of the garage into the darkness. I followed a bumpy private road for about a quarter of a mile. It finally connected to a main road with a stunning view of the island and the sea below. I accelerated the Street Fighter and felt the wind on my face, the dance of gravity and velocity pulling me toward oblivion or balance, life or death, when I took my first curve. Fuck yes! I finally felt free and myself for the first time in days. I had gotten Cairn's apartment's address from Burris while we had watched TV, and I headed northeast back toward the city on the other side of the island. I was going to enjoy the solitude on the way there. A single supernova headlight flashed behind me. So much for solitude. Another bike broke free of the wilderness and came off the same private road I had been on. You fucking kidding me, I muttered. The satellite radio was playing Kanye's Stronger. I accelerated and took another turn. The bike's headlight vanished from view only to reappear a second later as the driver took the curve fast trying to catch up. Okay, asshole, I hope your insurance is paid up. There was a straightaway, and I twisted the accelerator on the quarter of a million-dollar bike. The speedometer was climbing closer to 90. The bike was light as hell, and it had a fucking 200-horsepower rocket attached to it. The headlight of the other bike diminished. I slowed to take a steep turn that dipped downward as the road hugged the mountain's edge. The turn came out into a short straightaway, and then another turn, opposite to the last. The headlights were back by the time I cleared the second curb and were closing. Son of a bitch! The driver had taken those turns at close to full speed to catch up. I gunned the accelerator and the bike almost popped a wheelie. I was heading into another tight curve. I dipped the bike low to correct for the speed going through the turn. The grindstone of the road flashed inches from my face for a few seconds. Then I was up, loose rocks from the edge of the turn flying as I came out into another straight strip of highway and kept flooring it. The other bike took the turn. I glanced back to see the driver's leg flash out in a spray of gravel, and then the rider was clear and back on my ass. I was pretty sure now that the other bike was the fucking red Ducati from the garage, and that made it pretty clear who the rider was. How the hell he had shaken off the spell, I had no clue. There was the angry bleat of a car horn, and I snapped my head forward to see a convertible Jag barreling down on me. I had drifted over to the other side of the road at this speed. A split second was too long to get distracted. I swerved at 120 miles an hour and accelerated instead of braking, even though my instincts were screaming to stop. I was about 6 inches from the car's paint. I managed to keep it on the road. The guy driving the car flipped me off and screamed at me. His voice was lost in the tunnel of velocity. Another turn coming up at 140. I could feel the Street Fighter bucking like a titanium bronco, fighting against the contact patches on the tires, wanting to leave the pavement to fly into the sky. As fucked up as this was getting, I felt the same way. I had wished a few minutes ago that I had a drink or two in me to loosen me up, but now I was high on a much stronger drug. I was going to lose this crazy motherfucker, and there was only one way to beat a crazy motherfucker. I looked over at the coast below. The waxing moon was rising. Not full, but so large and bright it felt like you could touch it. The sea, the stars, the wind, the speed, I drank it all in, felt it burn in me like no pill or powder, no drink or smoke ever could. The turn was coming up, wide and sharp, dipping lower toward the rocks and sea far below. I hit the turn at 165, a literal half-second to scan the road below and ahead. Then I snapped off the headlight, plunging me into darkness. There was no thinking, no feeling,
All that existed was the moment. It was, I was. Act. No time for consequence, no time for weighing choices. My legs shot out from the left peg, and my steel-toed boot caught the guardrail solidly as I used it as a guide. I kicked off the rail and then counter-steered, turning the handlebars left instead of the instinctual right. Everything was rhythm now. The blink of an eye, a single thud of a heartbeat, the throaty growl of the engine. I straightened out the front wheel. There was the dizzy, sick feeling of my stomach settling in my balls as the road vanished under me with a hiss of gravel. The bike going airborne, finally getting its wish to leave the road behind, but only for a second. Impact. I turned into where the road should be. I was still up and still going into the yawning darkness. I had the accelerator jammed forward, trying to make as much time and get as much distance while he was literally in the dark as to where I was. I had no idea how much straightaway until the next turn. Time to Obi-Wan it. My third eye, my ajna, opened wide, and I was driving on pure mystical radar, which, contrary to the movies and TV, only gets you so far, especially when you're not calm, not ever at fucking peace, and have adrenaline tearing its way through your blood like a freight train. Far behind me was the rev of the Ducati's powerful engine as it cleared the curve jump, too. I saw the bouncing headlight, heard the distant scream of the tires for traction, and a whoosh of scattering gravel. He had almost gone over. The man was fucking deranged, clearly. I sensed the straight was about to give to another curve, another drop. I hit the turn, tires and suspension angry, jerking and wailing in protest at the speed and the angle as I launched off into space again. I didn't need mystic instincts to know I had pushed this game as far as I could. I snapped on the headlight and saw I was plummeting toward the end of a long straightaway I had just bypassed by going airborne. The bike landed, and I stood up on the pegs as it hit, then dropped and fought to keep it on the road going into the beginning of a new yawning curve headed to the bottom of the mountain. My speed had decreased considerably, but I now had a good half a mile or more of curves and road between me and Vigil. I accelerated out of the turn and along the straight line of the coast that was leading me toward the city. I checked behind me several times, but I seemed to have lost the night. I gave the road behind me the finger and kept on keeping on. The streets of Spetses were still crowded with tourists, mostly young, mostly beautiful, and all loaded in more ways than one. This whole place was a playground for the ultra-rich, people who had no clue what it did to a human being to have to sweat the rent or decide if they should buy food for their kid or buy the meds the kid needed. I couldn't help feeling like an intruder on this island as I glided the street fighter through the traffic. Most of these folks' biggest concern tonight was which restaurant or club to blow their money in. I didn't belong here. I never had. I know my own poorer-than-fucking-dirt background informs my opinion on all that. I had known plenty of rich folks sadder than fuck for real, and good reasons, but there was no denying sad and rich beat the shit out of sad and poor any day of the week and twice on Sunday. I found Karen's neighborhood and parked the bike across the street. Her building was whitewashed with a trim of bright blue. There was a tasteful wrought-iron fence around the building's grounds that included a courtyard with a few plastic beach chairs and a little round table under a stand of palm trees. There was an electronic lock next to the gate that required a tenant's keycard to open. I placed my hand on the box and whispered as I let the charge of power flow from my Manipura chakra, "Apertus!" The gate clicked open and I walked through. Karen's condo was up a short flight of stairs. She had the left side of the building, and someone else lived on the right. The first floor was about a half dozen smaller apartments. The ward hit me in the face walking down the hall to her door. Fey magic was formidable, but it was so fucking ostentatious it practically shouted at you. It was like they had to bling the hell out of even the simplest lock and alarm spell. I felt around the edges of the working and then snipped and silenced it with a few words. I stepped inside Karen Anku's life and closed the door behind me. The air conditioner hummed, set to keep the place comfortable for no one. The place looked more like a hotel than a teenage girl's home. Nice, cream-colored furniture, muted tones, a rug with no stains from Cheetos crunched underfoot or spilled Cokes. I frowned and walked the spacious rooms. They were silent to me, silent to even my ajna chakra. There were no traces of any significant emotional imprints on this place. Karen may have slept here
eaten here, watched TV here, but she hadn't lived here in any meaningful way. I found that very sad. Children, teens, usually smear the air with angry, brilliant colors of emotion and experience. I expected a teenage fairy princess to leave me a trail like a bunch of My Little Ponies had puked all over the place, fucking rainbows and glitter, but this... It told me a lot about her by how little it told. I sat down at the edge of her perfectly made bed. I wanted to smoke, but it felt like I was in a museum or something. I'm sure Sir Vigil would be giving me that look, the one I had already seen enough to call it that look if I lit up an American spirit in here. There was not even a faint charge of sexual energy from the bed, the bedroom. If she'd had raging hormones like most teenagers, she kept them in check like a Trappist monk, at least at this address. Some of this began to make some sense. Daddy set all this up and obliviously paid the bills here. This would be the last place on earth you'd get any sense of the real girl. I started opening cabinets and rummaging through things as a last feeble attempt to find anything I could use or track. I'm sure every gumshoe and private dick before me had done the same. I found a half-full bag of cat litter, two empty bowls, and some cat toys under the cabinet beneath the kitchen sink next to the household cleaners, folded paper grocery bags, and packages of yellow rubber gloves. I knelt down and found a few cans of wet cat food specially formulated for kittens near the back of the cabinet. During my rummaging and scrounging, I found something else. It was faint, faded from age and distance, I'd imagine. But there was a trace of some of Cairn's anahata, her heart energy here. The energy was drifting lazily around the toys, appearing like tiny green fizzy soda bubbles to my perception. She had loved this cat, loved it so much that it still showed years later. A bit more hunting, and I was able to find a tuft of gray cat fur in the cabinet. I could work with this. I found plastic sandwich bags neatly stored in one of the kitchen drawers, and I carefully placed the fur in one bag and a few of the frayed feathers from the end of a much-abused cat toy in another bag. I sealed them, folded them up, and tucked them in the pocket of my jeans. I also took a small, pink, gnawed-on rubber mouse. I squeezed it, and it squeaked. I stuffed the mouse toy in my pocket, too. I left everything as I had found it, and then switched off the lights on my way out. Waiting for me across the street from the condo, leaning against the red Ducati Desma Sedici, was Burris, with his arms crossed, giving me that look. He stood as I crossed the street toward him in the street fighter. "You know, young man, speed kills," I said. "You're lucky to be alive." I didn't get to finish my smart-ass remark. Vigil drove a jab into my jaw and followed it up a beat later with a half-knuckle strike to my solar plexus. I fell back onto my ass and couldn't breathe, and sure as hell couldn't incant any snappy magical Latin retorts. He took a step toward me, and as fluidly as water runs, drew a handgun from a holster located at the small of his back and thumbed back the trigger with a click.
"You ever try that shit again," he said calmly, "and I will put a bullet in your fucking kneecap. You don't need a kneecap to be a drunken piece of shit has-been, still pretending to be a legend."
"Fair enough," I wheezed as my breath came back to me. He slowly lowered the hammer on the gun, holstered it with one hand, and offered me the other hand to help me up off the street. I took it, and as I rose and he pulled, I drove a nasty sucker punch into the side of his face. He staggered back, his lips split just like mine. We were matchies now. "That's fair enough, too," I said, and spit some blood into the cleanest gutter I had ever seen. I pulled my forearms in and kept them up like my old boxing coach had screamed at me about a million times and shuffled back. Vigil rubbed his jaw and lip, examined his blood, rubbed it between his fingers and thumb, and then looked up at me.
"You throw a pretty good hook for an old white drunk," he said. "What finishing school of the mystic arts you learned that at?"
"Million-dollar boxing gym," I said. "Hull Street, Richmond, Virginia. The Hogwarts Pugilism Society would take me because the sorting hat said I was with House Hufflepuff Puff Pass. You?"
"Over the Rhine, Cincinnati," he said. "Finals were a bitch."
A Greek cop on a Vespa slowed and looked at the two of us facing off on the sidewalk. He was a cop for the tourists in a short-sleeved, light-blue button-down shirt with epaulettes, dark blue pants, and a cap.
For the genteel folk of Spetz's, he seemed to have left his riot gear and truncheon at home tonight. He looked more like an airline pilot than a cop, and he was smiling, which was weird. He flashed the beam of a mag light over us and asked something in Greek. I got the gist of it, which was the polite, these guys may be richer than Bill Gates version of, what the fuck are you two skells doing here? Vigil did the talking, keeping his gun out of view. He offered his identification to the cop, and I heard the name Anku tossed out liberally. The cop nodded, still smiling and seeming to apologize. He waved to us and puttered away on his little scooter. This shit is just surreal, I said. Vigil, standing next to me, nodded.
You never get used to it if you didn't grow up in it, he said. Different world for these people, different cops, different laws. We'll always be tourists, hired help.
You want to get something to eat? I asked.
Cool,
Vigil said. Chasing a moron on a $200,000 bike down a hill without a perfectly good road in the dark always makes me hungry. We both began to climb onto our bikes. Vigil picked up his helmet and adjusted its straps.
I wasn't fooling about the kneecap, he said.
Yep, I said. I kind of got that. How the hell did you shake off the working like that?
Oh, I felt it, he said, but it didn't take. I'm half fey on my pop side, whoever the fuck he was. A lot of magic just doesn't stick to me too well. Comes in handy when dealing with low-life sucker-punching wizard types.
You're an elf, I said. Vigil paused from pulling his helmet over his head and locked eyes with me. He knew that I knew what being an elf meant in his world.
You have a problem with that? He
said. It wasn't a question, it was a challenge. Nah, I said. Mind if I call you Dobby?
Mind if I beat all the red out of your neck?
His bike roared to life. I'll take that as a no, I said, and started the street fighter up. We pulled away from the curb in search of burgers and beers. 5. I woke up around 10 and prepared everything I needed for the ritual, pulling items from my old canvas bag. Vigil was up already, of course, out on the deck overlooking the fantastic view of the sea. He was doing Tai Chi in nothing but a pair of old torn sweatpants. He paused after a moment when he sensed me watching him. I'm going to start the working, I said, so leave me the fuck alone.
This is already turning into a good day,
he said and turned back to the ocean.
Remember, kneecap.
He settled into his form again and I flipped him off and walked back inside. I found an exercise room with a treadmill, some free weights, a rack with big exercise balls, and a wall of mirrors. It was perfect for what I needed. I dropped all the goodies I'd need on the floor, moved the equipment to a far corner of the room, shut the door, and locked it. I set up a small circle of squat, partially melted silver candles in front of the wall of mirrors. At the center of the circle, I placed a small, ancient, and weathered statue of a cat made of onyx and gold. I drew a chalk circle on the industrial carpet exactly 3 feet south from the circle of candles. I drew symbols above the circle for the opening of the Ma'at, and below the circle was the hieroglyphic name of the being I was entreating. I placed the tuft of cat fur, the feathers from the cat toy, and the small rubber mouse in a smaller circle, and then I lit the candles of the larger circle. I turned off the fluorescent overhead lights. The room was dark except for the light from the candles, reflected, jumping in the mirrored wall. I sat cross-legged exactly 7 feet away from the circle of candles and 4 feet from the chalk circle. I spent a few moments clearing my mind and regulating my breathing. I aligned my energies and felt the silence and shadow of the room begin to congeal. Time stuttered. Silently I began the prayers, venerable and precise, filled with formula and geometry that defined the undefinable. Named it, gave shape and dimension where none existed, called out to something primordial in the deepest recesses of the endless wheel of the Ma'at. The prayer was a silent song in my mind. I continued it and hoped one of the most capricious of goddesses would oblige me with her wisdom. It took a while, I knew it would, but I began to feel her silent approach through the tangled forest of the mind. I opened my eyes and saw in the reflection of the mirrored wall a shadow, deeper than the darkness of the room, pad gracefully toward the circle of candles. Her eyes were blazing amber. alien and devoid of any emotion or motive I would ever understand. She regarded the ritual and me through the reflection, searching for any reason, any flaw to allow her to pounce and devour me. Luckily for me, she found none. The mother of cats didn't deign to speak in human tongue. It was too demeaning for her. She snatched the thoughts from my head as easily as flashing out a paw to catch a mouse. She sifted my thoughts like streams of flowing sand and considered my request and my offerings. After a moment, the shadow with eyes of amber fire shifted, seeming to silently spill over to my side of the mirror. It devoured everything in the small chalk circle, and then, as it retreated to the other side of the mirror, it snuffed the ring of candles out. The room fell to darkness. I felt the goddess's presence striding away, tail swishing. I heard two squeaks of the rubber mouse. This window to the Ma'at closed, and she was gone. I stood, switched on the harsh overhead lights, and blinked. The chalk circle was empty, save for a tiny silver bell like you might find on a cat's collar. I picked it up and began to hear a tiny jingle in my mind. As I walked toward the door to the room, the frequency of the jingle increased. She had accepted my offerings and given me what I had asked for. I grabbed a shower, changed into black button-down jeans and boots. I walked past Vigil's room and heard his shower going as well. No sense in interrupting. I told one of the house servants downstairs to tell him where I was going before I left. I had a spare kneecap. I decided to take the bright blue Lamborghini Aventador today. It was a convertible, of course. Halfway down the mountain toward the city, the little bell's silvery tinkle in my head was getting faster and faster. I realized I was really hungry, having skipped breakfast to amuse a cat goddess. The car's stereo was playing Endless Sleeper by the Ravenettes, loud. I had the buzz that came from digging up a strong lead, being back on the hunt, one step closer to getting the answer. People have asked me my whole life why the fuck I get mixed up in shit like this. The simple answer is that it distracts me from my own sorry train wreck. Getting up in other people's business keeps me occupied and out of my own damn skull. So, no noble aspirations here. I'm no hero. Far the fuck from it. Just good old-fashioned self-interest. I keep hoping I'll run into some sorry son of a bitch one day more fucked up than me, or at least as badass, to boost my obviously flagging self-esteem and feed my passive-aggressive death wish. To date, no credible challengers. It took a little over an hour of tinkerbelling my skull to narrow the search once I hit the city. The ever-increasing ringing led me to a small cluster of waterside apartments and finally to the door of one on the third floor. These places were not as nice nor as expensive and exclusive as where Karen had lived. The neighborhood and the dwellings made me figure its tenants were mostly townies, the locals who did all the real work around here to keep the idle rich. Well, idle. No magic spells or locks on the door to apartment 3E. It opened easily enough with a simple working, and I was in. I snapped on the lights and saw, as well as felt, that this was a real home, a place someone had invested some of the energy of living into. Clothes were scattered over several pieces of furniture. There was an abandoned ring of jeans with panties coiled inside them about 3 feet from the door, like someone had come home from a rough day and shucked off their clothes right there. Takeout food boxes and cartons littered the coffee table beside a plastic, transparent, rainbow-colored bong, a baggie with weed, and about a dozen empty or half-empty diet soda and beer cans. Wandering the small four-room apartment, there were emotions, love, excitement, sadness, anger, desire, self-doubt, splashed about the air like someone had opened big cans of bright paint and spattered them about randomly. There was an insistent yowl, and a little gray and white cat padded out from the debris. Her paws were much bigger than the rest of her. Her eyes were the color of a stormy sky. She looked at me, and I looked at her. The bell in my skull silenced. This was the cat that had been in Karen's condo. I knelt down to pet her, and she bolted back to her hiding place. I had a way with women. For a second, I had thought it was going to be this easy, that Karen had changed her name and had been living the normal life of a 20-something within spitting distance of her old life, but checking through the piles of mail stacked up on the small table by the door dissuaded me of that premise.
This girl, Dree Elias, had bills and was behind on several. She had a job and benefit statements from her employer, including several past due notices on a loan against her 401k. These kinds of things were chum to any serious hacker or investigator, the kind of breadcrumbs that they could track from Life A to Life B. If Dree Elias had been Karen Anku, I would never have been.